15 seconds was pushing it. Les reached up and wiped his visor clean of precipitation. White caps extended across his field of vision, but there seemed to be a border to the east. Yes, a big landmass curving across the wide horizon. Cuba. 3 seconds after Michael had given the order, Les pulled his chute. Layla followed his lead. Their canopies bloomed outward, yanking them back up toward the storm, or so it seemed. Steering with his toggles, he flew his canopy toward Layla as they neared the DZ. The dome structure rose up at them, and as it came into view, he could see why Katrina had risked the dive despite the storm hazard above. Several boats were docked at the concrete piers jutting from the sphere. Cazadores. Or was this just an old fleet that had never left the island? Perhaps the defectors mentioned in the video had landed here and killed Dr. Julio Diaz and his team. They would find out soon enough.
Michael! Layla yelled.
Les found the red and blue battery units nearing the surface of the water. 7 seconds into his nosedive, Michael had caught up with her. Extending his arms, he grabbed her, wrapped his legs and arms around her, and then pulled his chute. The canopy jerked the divers upward. Les held his breath. It was a ballsy move, and Michael managed to keep his grip on Aaron in the process, but they had only 5 seconds left for the canopy to slow their speed before they hit the water. Les and Layla continued to slow their descent, creating more of a gap between themselves and Michael and Aaron. Even with the NVGs, it was hard to see them.
10!
Layla yelled even louder. A small splash went up where the two divers hit the water. Les continued steering himself toward a pier extending from the dock, but twisted slightly for a better look at the spot where they splashed down. He spotted flailing arms a moment later, but he had to focus on his landing. Pulling on his toggles to slow his descent, he did the two-stage flare. It would have worked just fine if the concrete platform weren't slick with rain. He ran out the momentum for several steps before slipping and falling on his back. He hit hard enough that he felt a little woozy.
Get up, numbnuts, get up!
Fighting his way out of his parachute, he unclipped one riser and anchored the chute so it wouldn't blow away. He glimpsed the ancient ship on his right and the hull speckled with rust and barnacles. It could be a Cazador ship for all he knew, or it could just be another artifact from the old world. He did a quick scan for contacts, and seeing none, hurried over to Layla. She had landed behind him, closer to the edge of the pier. She was already nearing the water's edge and screaming for Michael and Aaron. When Les got there, he looked out over the waves, but saw only white caps.
"Where are they?"
Layla asked, frantic. 100 meters out, movement caught his eye. Panting broke over the comm channel. Then a voice.
"Help! Help me with her!" Michael gasped.
Les unslung his rifle, took off the vest laden with flares and magazines, and kicked off his boots. Then he dived into the water. Layla jumped in after him. They swam side by side, kicking away from the platform and into the rough sea. Les hated dark water almost as much as he hated the dark skies, but at least the skies didn't hide fish that could swallow you in a bite, or giant octopuses like the one X and Magnolia had reported. He tried to shut out thoughts of whatever might be sharing the same water with him. Fear fueled his movements, and a minute later he was nearing the two chutes spread out like flattened mushrooms in soup. He put an arm under Aaron and helped Michael pull her back toward the dock. Layla swam alongside, freeing their chutes from their harnesses. They wouldn't be able to salvage those, but it beat the alternative of drowning with them still attached.
"Is she breathing?"
Layla asked. Michael nodded.
"She's alive."
He let out a painful grunt that told Les it had been a rough landing. As the divers made their way back to the docks, waves rolled in, blocking their view each time one slapped against them. Layla was first to the pier. She climbed up, then turned to help Les and Michael get Aaron out of the water. Les was so anxious to get out, he nearly jumped onto the concrete.
"We have to take off her helmet," Michael said.
Les checked the radiation reading on his wrist monitor. This area was a green zone. Odd, considering the storm that raged above them. Something was definitely off about this place. Michael eased Aaron's helmet off her head. Her eyelids were closed, and blood trickled from her nose. Layla pulled out a medical kit and fished through the contents.
"Open her mouth, Michael," she said.
He did as ordered, and Layla slipped a pill under her tongue.
If this doesn't wake her up...
Layla didn't finish her sentence. Les had used the adrenaline pills before. They acted fast, entering the bloodstream through the gums and veins in the mouth. Michael looked over his shoulder as they waited, and Les followed his gaze down the dock. Two ships were anchored there, but with no sign that anyone had been aboard in the past 100 years.
"Cazadores?" Michael asked.
"I don't think so," Les replied.
"Those are ITC ships," Layla said. "See the markings?"
She gestured at the nearer of the two, whose hull read Transport Cyber, with the rest of the letters too faded to read. A sudden gasp made Les whirl around as Aaron, eyes wide, shot up to a sitting position.
"Easy," Layla said, putting a hand on Aaron's shoulder. "Just breathe."
"It's okay," Michael added reassuringly.
He put a hand on her other shoulder. She looked at them in turn as she took in deep breaths.
What happened?"
"You were grazed by lightning," Michael said. "But you're going to be okay."
"Where am I?" she asked.
"Red Sphere," Michael said.
"Can you walk?" Layla asked.
Aaron pushed at the ground, her body quivering.
I don't know. Everything tingles."
A metallic clanking sounded in the distance, and the divers all looked toward the domed building set in the center of the round artificial island.
"Did you hear something?" Layla asked.
Michael nodded.
"Come on," he said. "Help me get Aaron up. We need to get out of the open."
13. A day had passed since the Seawolf left the Turks and Caicos. In that time, the vessel had traveled about 75 miles southeast, and they were nearing the eastern edge of the island of Hispaniola, which had once comprised the countries of Haiti and the Dominican Republic. But the boat was in bad shape. The remaining battery was down to a 61% charge, and the single engine was struggling to plow through 6-foot waves. Magnolia took a sip of herbal tea, hoping it would calm her sour stomach. She sat in her bunk with her knees pulled up to her chest, reading historical records she had pulled from the satellite station on the island. The cut on her scalp hurt like hell, worse after her fall off the bluff. Blinking over and over, she tried to clear her vision and concentrate on the tablet screen in her hands. Most of this was stuff she already knew, the history of ITC and the life of its wunderkind CEO, Tyron Red. Everything up to his assassination and what followed in the days immediately after he transferred his consciousness to a robotic body.
"Timothy, were you aware of this?" she asked.
The AI's voice replied from the single speaker in her small quarters.
"Exactly which part of this are you referring to, Magnolia?"
The part about a computer virus shutting down the grid across the world and then manipulating governments into blowing themselves to kingdom come. I always thought it was humans who did this."
"Oh, it was."
"How do you mean?"
There was a slight pause, just long enough for Magnolia to wonder whether the AI might be hiding something.
"Humans designed artificial intelligence."
"True, but you still haven't answered my original question."
"I did another scan, and I do not have anything in my database for the year 2043.
She lowered the tablet.
"What do you mean you don't have anything in your database?"
"I mean that I have zero files about events in that year."
"How is that possible?"
Another pause.
"What about the year 2042? She asked.
"I have over 1 million files for that year."
She grabbed her cup of tea and took another sip.
"What about 2044?
"There are thousands of files for that year, but not nearly as many as 2042 and before, and they are limited to the Hilltop Bastion and communications with other ITC facilities."
"Holy wastes," she muttered.
"I'm sorry I can't be of more assistance, Miss Khatib, but this data must have been lost in what Dr. Diaz is calling the blackout period."
"I guess so."
She brought the tablet up again. This time she did a search for Red Sphere, the top-secret lab where the doctor and his team had spent several years after the war. Maybe she had missed something in his audio and video clips. Maybe there was something more to this, an answer she had overlooked.
The boat suddenly rocked hard to starboard, the result of a rogue wave slamming into the port side. The impact nearly jolted the tablet out of her hand. She looked up at the bulkhead where the recessed light flickered.
"No, please don't," she whispered.
Miles lifted his head from where he was sleeping off his second feast of shark meat. It was the most movement she had seen from the dog in several hours. It seemed the fish was not agreeing with his stomach. A gurgling sounded, and he let out an audible fart. Magnolia chuckled until the light flickered off.
"Great. Just freaking great."
She laid the tablet down on the bunk to investigate what had caused the power outage. Whatever answers were in the data would have to wait. She swung her legs over the bed and put her naked feet on the cold metal floor. Then she grabbed her sweater and threw it over her uniform. A boisterous clanking came from outside her quarters. The noises were followed by another sound, like grinding gears. She found her flashlight and used it to get across the small space to her boots without tripping on her gear bags.
"Mags, where you at?" X shouted.
"Hold on."
After speed-lacing her boots, she moved into the dark passage where she flitted her light back and forth over the smooth black bulkheads.
"X, what happened?" she asked.
She got no answer right away. Not even Timothy replied.
"Because the system is down," she realized.
"X, where are you?"
"Right here."
She directed the beam behind her.
"No, up here."
The beam hit his face. He was bending down from the upper level.
"We just lost our battery power. Come on, I need your help."
Magnolia felt a twinge of dread at the news. This wasn't that much different from diving through a storm. They were at the mercy of Mother Nature until they got back online. The boat swayed, and she hit the bulkhead with her palm to keep from falling. She found the rungs after a few steps and made her way up into the staging area where X was already suited up.
"We have to go out and fix this ourselves."
He put his helmet on and tossed her a bag of gear. She moved over to the rack where she stored her suit, armor, and helmet. Holding the butt of the flashlight in her mouth, she shined the light on the equipment. Miles barked from the passage below.
"Calm down, buddy," X said. "We'll be back in a little while."
Holding two bags in his hands, he glanced over at Magnolia.
"Meet me outside."
She dressed as fast as she could, but by the time she was finished, X was already climbing into the engine room on the deck. Smoke rose out of the opening, toward the mast and into the dark sky. A fire down there could mean a few different things, all of them bad.
"Let's go," he shouted.
A light drizzle hit her as she stepped outside. Waves slapped the hull, rocking them from side to side. She balanced herself by holding her arms out and moving in a straight line to X. Smoke sneaking past him, he popped his helmet out of the opening to see where she was.
"Where's the other bag, Mags?"
She cursed and went back inside the boat to grab the tools. 2 minutes later, she was climbing down the ladder into the cramped engine room, essentially a utility closet with an overhead barely 4 feet high. Getting down on her knee pads, she crawled after X, trying to see through the smoke and using her hand to brush it away. Her knees scraped over the metal deck and through puddles of salt water. X rounded a corner and ducked into the passage where the batteries were stored. Magnolia used her headlamp to scan the area, but the inky smoke was hard to penetrate.
"Hand me that bag."
X reached back with one hand, but kept his helmet light directed at the mechanical equipment ahead. Magnolia glimpsed Engine 1 and the two lithium-ion battery units encased beside it. She pushed the bag forward and X dug inside for several moments while she held her light steady. He pulled out the small computer they used to diagnose mechanical issues, the same one that had failed to diagnose the first bad battery. This time, though, X managed to find the issue quickly.
"It's a bad wire," he said. "I should be able to fix this right now and bring the power back on. Battery still has 55% juice, too."
"Thank God," Magnolia whispered.
"Still doesn't tell us what's creating the smoke," he said. "I'll deal with that next."
After a half hour of cursing and clanking, he had the new wiring in place.
"All right. Should be good to go."
He let out a grunt, and the lights suddenly came back on, filling the space with a white glow. A confused voice immediately came over the comms.
What happened?
Didn't think I'd be happy to hear your voice again, Pepper, X said.
Thank you, sir.
I'm gonna try and get the engine back online, X said.
Can I help? Magnolia asked. She crawled after him toward the still smoking engine. Her hands slipped in a puddle. Not water this time.
Careful, X, she said. We got oil.
I've just run a quick scan of the boat, Timothy said over the open channel. Unfortunately, it looks as though Engine 1 is damaged beyond repair.
X directed his helmet light inside the engine.
We have a melted corner of a piston crown, he said after he opened the casing.
Several curses followed.
He played his beam over several areas while fanning away the smoke.
Looks like that last wave hit us so hard it destroyed the compression ring lands and piston pin. I bet a lot of the metal is inside the crankcase and has contaminated the bearings and oil passage.
What does that mean? Magnolia asked. He twisted to face her.
Means we're hosed unless we can get the sails up.
Or unless the divers find a boat in Cuba, she thought.
Michael crouched next to Aaron. They had taken refuge on the deck of the ITC ship docked outside Red Sphere. Interference from the storm made it impossible to reach command. Worse, they didn't have a path home. It was one thing to dive through a pocket of electricity like that, but rising back up through it with a helium balloon was suicide, pure and simple.
Drink, he said, bringing a bottle to Aaron's lips. She opened her thick lips and took a gulp, coughed, and reached up to wipe her mouth.
I can do it on my own, she said, taking the bottle from him. I'm not paralyzed.
No, but you're still stubborn as ever, Michael thought.
Aaron was in bad shape, there was no denying it, and Michael had a feeling she wasn't being honest about just how bad. They didn't have any way of knowing whether she had internal injuries from the lightning. The suits were designed to help mitigate and distribute the 300 kilovolts of energy from an oblique arc, but they couldn't save a body from a direct strike. She was lucky to be alive. There was likely a lot of damage he couldn't see, including burst blood vessels that could cause major problems later. What he could see was the burn mark on her back. They had already rubbed cream on the wound and applied a cool patch to help dull the pain, but it was still bothering her.
It itches, Aaron whispered.
Layla thrust her fist in the air.
Everyone quiet.
The three divers sat in silence in the dark, listening to the clatter and groan of constantly shifting metal all around them as waves rocked and jostled the ship. Michael checked the time again. Les should have been back. He stood up with his rifle and moved over to the hatch. Not wanting to break radio silence, he decided to take a look for himself.
I'll be right back, he whispered.
Layla's helmet dipped once and Aaron gave a thumbs up. Michael gritted his teeth as he walked into the hallway. Aaron wasn't the only one injured. Smacking into the ocean had hurt both his legs. His right was really bad. A sprain, or maybe even a hairline fracture. Keeping low, he moved down the passage. Water dripped from the overhead, collecting in a puddle on the floor. He stepped around it, cautious not to make any extra noise. The NVGs provided an eerie, narrow green view of the passage ahead. He headed for the bow, where Les had last gone to scope things out. Halfway down the hall, Michael froze at a noise that could be footfalls. He listened to the echo, trying to home in on their location. Turning, he saw a hulking figure at the other end of the hall. A flash hit him in the face shield.
Just me, Commander, Les said.
Michael raised a hand to block the light and clicked off his NVGs. If Les was using his helmet light, then he thought the coast was clear.
Scared the crap out of me, Michael said, lowering his rifle.
Ship's all clear, Les confirmed.
Michael gestured back toward the quarters where Layla and Aaron were waiting. Les ducked under the overhead and stepped inside.
No one sailed this thing for hundreds of years, Les said, and I doubt Samson can get it running again. Everything's old-school technology. Freaking engine room has diesels.
At least it's not a Cazador pirate ship, Layla said.
No sign of those freaks?
Les's helmet wagged.
None.
But there is something I think you should see.
He looked to Michael.
Can you walk, Aaron? Michael asked.
She pressed her hands to the deck and got herself up with Layla's help.
Just you, Commander, Les said.
Aaron and Layla both looked over at Michael.
You two stay here, he said. We'll be right back. Open comms if you need anything.
He followed Les back into the passage and down a ladder to a lower deck. Their helmet beams guided them through the metal warren of dark passages. Cobwebs of rust covered the bulkheads, disguising any markings from centuries ago. Michael racked his brain over how this ship was still afloat after all this time. Hurricanes, storms, barnacles, and rust had had their way with it. And yet here it still was. There had to be another explanation. Perhaps it was resting on concrete piers, or...
Down here, Les said, gesturing right at an intersection.
They walked through an open hatch and down another ladder, deeper into the bowels of the vessel. Les ducked under another overhead and came out on a veranda overlooking a massive room that appeared to be some sort of warehouse. Metal crates, all of them open, rested on the deck 20 feet below.
This is the place, Les said.
He walked out onto the metal platform and over to a railing, shifting his light to the deck beneath them. Michael joined him at the ledge and directed his helmet beam where Les was pointing.
What in the wastes is that? Michael asked.
Les shook his head.
I was about to ask you the same thing.
For a moment, he just stared at the mass grave below, trying to make sense of what his eyes were relaying to his brain. Below them, hundreds of bones lay in a bed of red moss. But they weren't just randomly thrown there. The bones were put back together in a deliberate way, making the skeletons look
pretty eerie, Les said.
Let's get the satellite link up. I want to contact Command and let them know there's something down here after all. Then we start looking for supplies and boats.
Michael tried to back away from the railing, but he couldn't pull his eyes away from the mossy red growth on the deck and the bones. These weren't just human. There were animal bones down there, and robotic-looking parts mixed in like some sort of Frankensteinian fantasy.
You think those are the defectors that killed Dr. Julio Diaz and his team? Les asked. Or maybe that is Diaz's team.
Michael had trouble formulating a response. He was too busy trying to make sense of a skeleton that had a buffalo skull attached to a human ribcage, robotic arms, and bony hands with claws.
What kind of hell island did Katrina send us to? He whispered.
It was a rogue pocket of electrometric disturbance, said Dave Connor, avoiding Katrina's gaze. It was his job to decipher the hundreds of readings coming from the airship's advanced sensors, but she didn't blame him for this.
This is not your fault, Dave, she said. This was my decision, and it's on me. Besides, everyone knows how tough a rogue pocket is to spot.
I should have seen it, Dave said, shaking his head. I'm sorry.
Ada twisted around from her station, concern written on her freckled face.
How will they get back up here if that storm doesn't pass?
We'll find a way, Katrina said.
She returned to the helm where she slumped in the leather chair. The porthole window hatches were up, and she stared out into the ocean of black. Seeking refuge here, away from the other officers, seemed cowardly in a way, but she couldn't help feeling she had made a mistake in flying Deliverance to Red Sphere. Somewhere 25,000 feet below, the four most experienced divers, aside from her, were possibly dead or in serious peril. Even if they had survived the rogue layer of storm clouds, they were stranded with no way of getting home. And she had no idea what was down there. All the data, transmissions, and videos from Dr. Diaz's team suggested that this place was nothing but a tomb. But then there were always threats on the surface. The wait to hear from a dive team, though always agonizing, was worse than normal this time. Her boot rapped syncopated rhythms on the deck, as behind her, Ada, Dave, and Bronson continued monitoring their screens and sipping their cups of caffeinated water. It was going to be a long day. An hour had passed since the divers leaped from the belly of Deliverance, and it had already felt like a lifetime. An unenlightening half-hour later, she got up and walked back to the circular command station.
Have you detected anything yet, Ensign?
A negative, ma'am, Bronson White replied.
So far, none of the beacons are getting through the electromagnetic disturbance. Nothing over the comms either, Ada confirmed.
An insane thought crossed her mind, one she didn't dare say aloud. There were still over 50 people on Deliverance, farmers, engineers, cooks. She couldn't risk their lives. Yet.
Ada, get me the Seawolf, she said.
Will do, ma'am.
Grabbing her headset, Katrina retreated back to her leather chair to stare out the portholes. She already knew what X would say, but she wasn't calling him to ask for advice.
Captain, Ada said, I've got Timothy Pepper on the horn, but he says X and Magnolia are preoccupied.
Patch him through, Katrina replied.
Hello, Captain DeVita. What a pleasant surprise to hear your voice.
It felt odd to talk to the second AI after deactivating its clone on the Hive.
Good to talk to you, Timothy, she said politely. Where are X and Magnolia?
They're working to fix the mainmast, he said.
Is there something I can assist you with?
I'd like to know if Magnolia or you have discovered anything else I should know about Red Sphere. If there's anything vital that I may have missed in those files Magnolia sent.
What exactly are you wanting to know?
Based on what you have scanned in the files, do you believe there is anything alive down there?
Timothy's reply came without hesitation.
In my experience, life always seems to find a way, and while nothing on those files confirms it, I do believe it's possible, Captain. In fact, I would say it's very likely.
14. Les was anxious to escape Red Sphere and get back to Deliverance, but they had their orders from Commander Everhart. The mission would continue, even after his horrifying find back in the guts of the ITC ship.
What the hell were those things?
He tried to push the ugly images from his mind as he proceeded across the pier and away from the ships, keeping his rifle cradled across his chest, eyes roving for potential hostiles. He ran toward his next objective. In the center of a spherical island stood a three-story metal building. Like many of ITC's facilities, this one had no windows and few entrances. But unlike most of the buildings back in the wastelands, this one had no markings whatsoever. No signage, nothing. The aerial view had him wondering whether this might in fact be one of the metal islands that X and Magnolia were searching for. But there was no evidence of the cannibalistic Cazadores, or Sunshine, or anything alive, and so far, the only two ships they had found were rust buckets. They had several other vessels yet to search, though. He had seen them on the dive-in, and planned to get a better look as soon as he had the satellite uplink set up. He glanced up at the swirling storm above him, where the clouds expanded like a rising loaf of bread. Lightning punched through the mass to give a fleeting glimpse higher into the heavens. Trey was up there, wondering where the hell his old man was.
I've got this, kid. Leave it to Pops.
Wind-driven salt spray beat against him on the final stretch away from the pier. He looked over the side at the waves slapping the concrete. It would take hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years for wind and sea to finish the structure off. Les jogged the rest of the way to the central structure where two massive steel doors sealed off the only entrance he had seen so far. As he ran, the howling wind gained strength, slamming his body. He pushed through a gust toward a rusted ladder leading to the flat rooftop three stories above, where radio towers rose into the sky. That was his objective, the place Michael had told him to set up the satellite comm and try to get a signal to Deliverance. He slung his rifle and started up the ladder. A glance over his shoulder halfway up gave him a decent view of the pier he had left behind. Two massive naval cruisers stood moored at the dock. On the weather deck of the ship to his left stood Michael, watching him with a pair of binoculars. Les continued up to the roof. Several lightning scars marked the flat concrete surface. It would have been a great place to land a supply crate, but they couldn't risk dropping precious supplies into the ocean. He trotted across the roof past the radio towers to search the rest of the facility. Four piers stretched away north from the platform, and several more to west and east. With his rifle scope, he zoomed in on a boat docked below, tethered by chains to thick steel bollards. This vessel looked different from the two ships where the other divers were sheltered. Barely a third their size, it looked like a fishing boat, with nets still lying on the deck where they had been abandoned.
No way that's been here for 260 years.
Les scanned the area a final time and discovered two more ships, one of them a military vessel with deck cannons and armor plating. He zoomed his scope in on the hull. Although the flag painted there was faded, he could make out the blue and red stripes and white stars. United States of America. This was the first time in his life he had seen the actual flag. He felt a stirring of emotion, knowing that this country had once been the most powerful in the world. Hundreds of millions of humans had lived there for centuries in what people from the Hive would consider luxurious conditions. But a single AI virus had brought the great nation down in just days and destroyed the entire world within weeks, leading to the blackout. The flag had been a symbol of strength and freedom, and today it also represented an opportunity. If they could get the ship working, they would have a way to fight the Cazadores. With that thought came a chilling realization. Katrina hadn't sent them here for supplies. She sent them here to find military vessels that could help X and Magnolia if they ever found the Metal Islands. A transmission hissed in his helmet.
What's your status, Raptor 4?
Michael's voice snapped Les out of his speculations.
Preparing to set up the SATCOM, Commander.
Roger.
Les trotted back to the towers centered in the rooftop where he took a knee, pulled out the satellite dish from his cargo pocket, and expanded it. The wind whipped against him as he worked, rippling his uniform. He had done this plenty of times before, but hacking into each facility was different. He used his mini-computer and extra battery to power the satellite link. Ideally, he would run it through the towers on the roof, but the power to Red Sphere appeared to be down. Lightning flashed bright overhead, and he braced for the crack of thunder. The faster he worked, the better. He didn't want to end up getting zapped like Aaron. After several minutes of fiddling with the equipment, he finally had it working. He extended the antennas and synced his mini-computer with the satellite. He had a signal, but it was weak. Les sent his first transmission to Deliverance.
Command, this is Raptor 4. Do you copy? Over.
Static crackled inside his helmet. He waited a few seconds, then repeated the message. Still no response. After three more tries, he glanced up at the sky. The storm was too intense to penetrate, even via satellite, which reaffirmed the fact that they would not be riding their helium balloons back to the airships. That left him with only one option. He left the equipment on the rooftop and ran back to the ladder, climbing down to the platform. Michael had his rifle out on the stern of the ship, and Les waved at him. They met on the deck, where Les explained the situation. Michael said,
"Guess we'll have to go inside and try to get the power back on to activate the radio tower. If we're lucky, we can get a transmission to Deliverance."
Les gave a nod.
"What about Aaron?"
"I'm leaving her here with Layla. It's safer."
"Agreed."
The two divers returned to the quarters on the ship. Aaron was on her feet.
"You're not leaving me here, so don't even try."
Les frowned. Apparently, they had kept the channel open outside.
"You two seem to forget who the weakest links are," Layla added. "You need both of us."
"Hey, I'm not discriminating," Michael said. "But Aaron, you did just take a nasty shot of lightning."
"And I said I'm fine."
Les could see that Michael wasn't in the mood to argue.
"Fine, but if you start to drag, we're stashing you somewhere while we search Red Sphere."
"Deal."
The divers packed up their gear and followed Les into the passage. Aaron managed to walk on her own until they got to the ladder on the ship. She stopped, trying to disguise the pain by turning her head the other way, or so it looked to Les, but he could still hear her labored breaths. And she wasn't the only one injured. Michael had a limp to his gait.
"Maybe I should just go with Layla."
Moving into Red Sphere with two injured could be a liability, especially if they were all forced to run at any point. On top of that, Layla and Michael were too close emotionally, which already compromised them, although Les had never said a word about that. He held rank on the airship, but when it came to diving, Michael was the boss. All Les could do was make a recommendation. He stopped at the ledge of the ship, waiting for the thunder to pass before speaking.
"Commander, all due respect, but why don't you let Layla and me proceed to Red Sphere? You're hurt, Aaron's hurt, and again..."
He held up both hands.
If we run into trouble, you both are going to be a liability.
Layla put a hand on Michael's armored shoulder.
He's right.
Yeah, Michael replied. Aaron snorted.
Keep the comms open, Michael said. If anything seems off, you tell me.
Understood, Commander, Les said. He gestured toward Layla. Follow me.
She paused and said over a private channel something that Les couldn't make out. Then they were off. Jumping onto the dock, Les noticed a patch of orange barnacles that he didn't recall seeing earlier. There was also a growth of reddish moss, the same stuff he had seen in the bizarre graveyard inside the ITC ship. Les had heard about the moss before. Michael had mentioned finding some at the Hilltop Bastion where Commander Rick Weaver was killed, but no one knew what it was, and Les avoided the strange growths. As they approached the building, Layla pumped several shells into her shotgun. Then she slung the weapon and pulled out her handheld tablet. When they got to the wide entrance doors, Les wiped off the triangular security panel with his sleeve.
Let me, Layla said.
Pulling a cable from her cargo pocket, she uncoiled it and plugged one end into her tablet, the other end into the panel. Les stood watch, rifle up.
Michael told me about the creepy boneyard back on the ship, Layla said. Any idea what that's all about?
My guess. I think the Cazadores were here at some point and had something to do with it. Either that or it's what's left of Dr. Diaz's team.
Or the defectors Diaz talked about in the video.
Could be. A beeping sounded, and she bent to look closer at the screen, tapping at the monitor.
Two more codes to crack.
Les continued to scan the area with his rifle while they waited. 2 minutes later, the doors creaked open to a cavernous space frozen in time. Several old-world military vehicles sat in the front of the garage. They were armored with mounted weapons and welded metal cages covering the windows. Their headlamp beams flashed around the room, lighting up cobwebs and floating dust particles disturbed for the first time in God only knew how long. Not far behind the vehicles were several skeletons, curled up where they had died. Layla pointed at them, and Les took a step forward, his boots crushing metal. Bending down, he found spent bullet casings.
Reminds me of Hilltop Bastion, Layla said. And you know what we found there, right?
Les replied.
Sirens.
The very thought froze him where he stood. This place gave him the creeps. First, the horrifying scene on the ITC ship, and now a scene of slaughter. He didn't want to keep walking into the dark building, but he didn't have a choice. Sirens or no sirens, his mission was to get the satellite link up and running.
Come on, he said to Layla.
She kept her shotgun slung over her armor and pulled out the Uzi as they walked deeper into the garage, shell casing snapping and cracking under their boots. On the other side of the vehicles, a door stood ajar. Les grabbed the handle and slowly pulled it open. Layla squeezed through with the Uzi up. Following her into a passage, Les could see over her head since she was a good foot and a half shorter than he. Layla motioned toward an elevator ahead. They stopped near the open doors and shined their beams into the shaft. The beams shot into the darkness, but he couldn't see the bottom.
Let's try and find another way down, Layla said.
They walked side by side to an intersecting corridor. On the right lay another body, mummified in the closed space. This had been a woman. Scraps of a chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear hazard suit covered her dry skin, and a helmet with a crushed visor encased her head. To the left, the passage was blocked with metal barriers, all of them pocked with bullet holes. They took a right, continuing deeper into Red Sphere, their lights sweeping over evidence of another battle. Brown streaks led to a door on the right side of the hallway, and Les saw the first signage in the building. It simply read, Stairs.
Let's try it, he said.
Layla opened it into a concrete stairwell. She slipped inside and set off toward a landing below. Les shuddered with dark imaginings of what awaited them. They continued down flight after flight for several minutes. Oddly, there were no doors at any of the first 10 landings. This building was buried deep beneath the waves. Layla finally stopped at the first door. Les opened it and moved into a passage.
His headlamp revealed more metal barricades blocking the end of the hallway. At a door on the right, he stopped and gave a hand signal. Layla met him there and tried the knob. Locked. She pulled out a small packet from her vest and shook out some lock-picking tools. Wait, Les said. His beam had revealed another way into the room. About 10 feet down, a window had been shattered. Moving cautiously around the broken shards, he directed his light to a gap in the furniture piled up against the window. On the far left, something had broken its way in.
I'll go first, Layla said.
He helped her climb onto the windowsill. A shard of glass dislodged from the mullion, hitting the floor with a crunch. Les lifted her higher, and she dropped through the gap.
I'll be right back, she said.
Les waited in the hallway while she searched the other space. 2 minutes later, the handle clicked and the door opened. Their two beams speared through the darkness, uncovering a space filled with laboratory workstations and storage areas. Some of the surfaces still held vials and medical equipment.
Holy shit, she whispered.
Layla held her light on another body at the other end of the room. Normally, corpses didn't bother her, but Les quickly saw why this one did. It was split in half, lengthwise. He moved over and crouched down beside the female skeleton, also wearing a CBRN suit. Even the helmet had been split smoothly down the middle. Black grooves extended away from the remains where the weapon had carved the floor in a straight line.
What kind of blade could do this? Layla asked.
I don't know, but I doubt it was the Cazadores. Les straightened up and kept moving through the lab. Tools and shattered monitors littered the floor. They explored the rooms for the next half hour and finally emerged into a clean room. Suits hung from hooks and helmets were stacked neatly on a shelf. Much of the place seemed undisturbed. Whatever happened here had happened fast. The next door, blown completely off its hinges, led to offices furnished with desks, several couches, and more monitors. Layla shined her light at a framed map on the wall. Hurrying over to it, she brushed off a thick layer of dust and pointed at the cracked glass.
Looks like the operations center, she said. It's a few levels from here.
She led the way, and Les followed, sweeping his light and rifle over more debris. The next hallway had been barricaded with furniture and steel door frames, which had done little to hold back the defectors, whoever the hell they were. A nearly perfect line had sliced through the barriers, leaving a 3-foot gap between the pieces. The floor was marked with the same black groove as in the first lab. The more Les saw, the more this looked like what he had seen on the rooftop. Maybe it wasn't lightning after all up there.
A blade didn't cut that person in half, Layla said. This was some sort of laser.
Les remembered the video from Dr. Diaz saying the defectors had military-grade arms. Maybe their fabled laser weapons weren't a myth after all.
Come on, we're almost there, he said, flattening his body and squeezing through the gap in the barrier.
Halfway through, he stopped, his light capturing a scene on the other side.
What's wrong? Layla asked.
Les swallowed hard, unable to form a response. Skeletons. Dozens of skeletons. All of them cut into pieces like butchered animals. Guns, some sliced in two, lay next to their former owners. Burn marks crisscrossed the overhead and walls. A battle had happened here, and from the looks of it, the losses were one-sided. Could this be Dr. Diaz and his team?
What do you see? Layla asked, trying to move past him.
He moved ahead to let her in. They had to go through the mass grave to get to the operations center. She took in the scene of carnage better than he had expected. Keeping her voice low, she said,
"Lasers."
Les held his breath as he passed through the slaughterhouse, as if he were trying to keep out the scent of rot, even though little was left but skeletons and tattered suits. He halted at another door, also broken off its hinges. Layla went first, and he followed her into the room, where dozens of monitors lined the walls. All the chairs and desks were gone, used in the barricade in the hall they had just left behind.
I'll try to bring on backup power, Layla said.
Les nodded and stood at the doorway, trying his best not to look at the corpses strewn about. Their bodies were sliced in almost perfect lines. but the more he thought about it, the less shocked he was at the display of firepower. After all, this was nothing compared to the power of a nuclear weapon. The real question now was, who were the defectors?
"I'm in," Layla said a few minutes later. "I think I can tap into a battery and get your uplink working topside."
Les moved to watch her work. She had a single screen online, its glow covering them in an eerie blue. Tapping the monitor, she said,
"Bringing on battery backup in 3, 2, 1.
The lights suddenly flickered and lit up the room. He turned to look at the hallway. Brown streaks painted the walls, blood and gore of those who had perished here.
"Okay, let's see if this works," Layla said. "Go ahead and try the uplink."
Les raised his wrist computer, which was still synced with the satellite on the rooftop. With a cord, he patched the computer to the screen, and Layla did the rest.
"Command, this is Raptor 2," she said. "Do you copy?"
White noise broke over the channel, and then a voice.
"Copy you, Raptor 2. This is Ensign White. It's great to hear your voice."
Les checked his first impulse, and instead of whooping with joy, he drew in a long breath of relief through his nostrils.
"Same here, Ensign White," Layla replied.
"Captain DeVita is currently not on the bridge, but I'll connect you, Raptor 2.
Les checked his magazine while they waited, a nervous tick since he had yet to fire his weapon. He ejected it, then palmed it back in with a click.
"Raptor 2, this is Captain DeVita," she panted. "Is everyone okay down there?"
"Les and I are fine, but Aaron and Michael were both injured on the dive."
"How bad?"
"They'll be okay, but as you probably know, we're stranded here by the storm."
"I know," she said. "I'm working on figuring a way to get you all home. In the meantime, have you been able to search the facility and docks?"
"Yes," Les replied. "I think I found what you sent us here for. It's a military vessel. Looks like some sort of stealth boat, but I don't know if we can make it run. Commander Everhart ordered us to contact you first."
"A stealth boat," Katrina said.
A brief pause of white noise sounded.
"Your mission is to get that ship working."
Layla and Les exchanged a glance, but before either of them could reply, a distant screech like rusty hinges echoed through the room. They both turned to look into the corridor.
"What the bloody hell was that?" she whispered.
Les shook his head.
"I have..."
The sound came again, like an axle that needed greasing, followed by an electronic wail that reminded him vaguely of a bird. His first thought was sirens.
"Layla."
"Les, do you copy?" Katrina asked.
"We're here," Les said.
"But I think something else is, too."
The bird-like screech continued, growing louder. Les flicked the safety off his rifle and brought it up to his shoulder. He stepped out into the hallway, careful not to crunch any broken glass. He pivoted right, training his rifle on the elevator shaft at the other end of the passage, well past the ghastly remains strewn about. Several recessed lights in the ceiling flickered, still working after all these years, but long sections of hallway were still in shadow. He took another step, his boot crunching a shard of glass. A screech rose from the open elevator shaft, and a sudden orange glow lit the inside where the doors had been pulled back. Looking closer, he saw claw marks in the metal wall and the frame. Les pulled his hand off the stock of the carbine, holding the gun in one hand and signaling Layla with the other. She didn't need verbal orders. She knew that it was time to run. 15. Sheets of rain pummeled the Seawolf in choppy waters. X aimed the spear gun at the top of the mainmast, waiting for the right moment to fire.
"Get ready, Mags," he yelled.
She moved into position next to the mainmast. They had brought the sails up from the lower deck and fastened them to the mainmast and mizzenmast. The next step was to try to straighten the kinked mainmast without snapping it at the top. If that happened, they were dead in the water. With nothing but the rudders to orient them, the vessel was already at the mercy of the waves, and it was really starting to make X cranky. He kicked away a bloody shark fin that came skidding across the slick deck, then planted his boots firmly, careful not to slip in the sticky blood pooled near the stern where he had butchered the carcass before dumping most of it overboard. The vessel briefly leveled out, and he seized the moment to squeeze the trigger. The tip penetrated the hollow mast and broke through the other side. The line from the spear tautened, and the winch engaged. He grabbed the wheel handle and began to crank it manually. The line could handle up to a ton of resistance, perhaps a bit more. After all, it had dragged a giant shark through the water back at the Turks and Caicos Islands. Looking up, he watched the mast begin to bend back into place.
Pepper, do you copy?
Sweat stung his eyes.
Copy you, sir. Make sure we've got our back to the wind, X ordered.
He squinted as if that would help him see through the water running down his visor. Across the deck, near the stern, stood Magnolia. He felt a slight change in course under his boots as the AI worked the rudders. The Seawolf cut through the water as he continued cranking the winch.
Okay, let's go, X shouted.
Magnolia grabbed a halyard and began pulling back on it, lifting the mainsail up the newly straightened mast. Once it was most of the way up, she transferred to the winch. She wrapped a rope three times around the drum and then began cranking the winch manually.
Careful, Mags, X yelled.
The wind had picked up over the past half hour, and too much added pull could break the mast. He checked the top again before cranking it tighter. The mast was almost straight now. X moved over to help Magnolia with the winch. She kept cranking and shook her head at him.
I've got this, she said.
X grabbed the halyard to keep the mainsail from flopping around as she raised it toward the top of the straightened mast.
Almost there, Mag shouted.
The wind filled the sail, and the Seawolf moved faster, or so it seemed. They both took a step back to look at their contraption. For this to work, the line from the spear gun had to hold. It meant they wouldn't be able to use that weapon for its intended purpose, but they had several others and plenty of firepower in the top cabin. The most important thing to do now was keep moving. And moving they were. X walked around the mast to take another look at the spear. He stopped when he saw the front of the black sail and felt a little swell of pride.
I'll be damned.
What? Magnolia asked. She joined him before the sail and put her hands on her duty belt, clearly impressed.
Wow. That looks pretty amazing.
Looks kinda like Miles, X said, studying the sail.
Someone back on the hive had done one hell of a job with the stitching. The face of a wolf towered above them, the deep yellow eyes looking ahead at the storm clouds, watching out over them.
Let's get to work on the other sail, X said.
At the stern, they followed the same process with the winch and halyard to raise the smaller sail. The wind pummeled them as they worked, but moving together, Magnolia and X finally managed to get it raised.
Good job, old man, she said when they finished.
You too, kid.
His words trailed off when he saw the skyline to the southeast. Magnolia finished tightening another rope, but X walked toward the starboard side, where the barbed wire still lined the rail.
Where you going? She called out.
X halted next to the rail, wary of any beasts lurking in the dark water. But his eyes weren't on the whitecaps slapping against the hull. They were on the strange light area in the sky. On the horizon, diagonal lines streaked down toward the ocean. The sheets of rain seemed so perfect, the view could have been an old-world painting. But this was real.
Mags, you seeing this?
She joined him starboard of the mainsail. To the southeast, the storm was definitely a paler shade, almost a light purple.
What in Hades is that? She asked.
X held up his wrist monitor and clicked on the cracked screen to pull up a map of their location. They appeared to be northwest of the strange skyline.
Timothy, where are we exactly? He asked over the channel.
East of Puerto Rico, and about 15 miles northwest of the Virgin Islands, sir.
Change course. Head southeast. I want to check something out.
Roger, Commander. The wind pummeled the sails as the boat turned. X and Magnolia continued to stare at the sky. The shades of purple and light blue streaked across the horizon like a ripe bruise.
It's a beacon, he said.
How's that?
Magnolia shot him a sidelong glance.
Explorers once used the stars like a map to guide them. We have something even better to guide us to the Metal Islands.
You think that's...
Magnolia could not take her eyes away from the strange lightning in the southeast.
Come on, kid. Let's get back inside. We have work to do.
She followed him across the slippery deck, looking over her shoulder several times as Timothy piloted the boat through the rough waves. If this led where X thought it led, they would need to prepare. He stopped before opening the hatch to the cabin and looked up at the image of the wolf flapping in the wind. The sea wolves were finally nearing their objective.
Stay put. It's too dangerous right now.
Hearing Layla's voice, Michael ran faster across the pier despite his injuries. He moved away from the ITC ship where he had left Aaron. He was breaking the cardinal rule of diving on the surface, never split up. But what choice did he have? He kept his rifle cradled as he moved. Both legs hurt with every step. The impact with the ocean had rubbed muscle against the kneecap and it felt as if his muscles were grinding over the bone.
Where are you, Layla?
He said, trying his best not to shout.
Tell me where you are.
Her voice hissed over the channel.
We're hiding in the command center, but it's...
Another screech sounded, and then the channel went dead. Michael slowed in the middle of the pier, rain coursing down his visor, breath steaming the inside.
Son of a bitch!
He wasn't sure what to do, although he definitely wasn't going to hide. He opened a channel to Aaron.
Can you make a topside?
Yes, Commander.
Good. We may need you as a sniper. I'm going into Red Sphere.
Figured you would.
Be careful. And good luck, Commander.
Same to you.
He continued toward the open doors where Layla and Les had entered. His fast pace across the platform surrounding Red Sphere brought a surge of pain up his knees and thighs, and by the time he reached the garage, he was gritting his teeth. An electronic wail came from inside the building the moment he crossed into the dark garage. This place was no tomb after all. The distant electronic discord gave him a chill. Red Sphere wasn't an abandoned outpost. Like many other ITC facilities, it was a haven for the beasts. He had trusted Captain DeVita just as he had once trusted Captain Jordan, and before him, Captain Ash. Now the most important woman in the world to him, and arguably one of the most important men left in the world, were trapped inside. He could hardly run, and Aaron was injured and alone back on the ITC ship. Sometimes you just had to get it done yourself, even when you weren't in any shape to do it. Bringing up his rifle, he moved toward the two armored vehicles. Layla and Les had gone idle on his HUD, but they were still alive. He could see their beacons. Neither moved. She had severed the channel to keep quiet, he realized. He slowed to a walk and skirted both vehicles, clearing the room in a quick sweep. Light flickered beyond the open door. The other divers had successfully turned on the battery backup, but they had also woken something best left dormant. But how could anything have survived here so long? In his mind's eye, he saw the bone pile back on the ITC ship. The sirens must have moved back into Red Sphere after exhausting the supplies and food source up here. It was the only explanation. He moved through a door into the hallway. Recessed lights lit some sections of the passage, while other sections were in shadow. Rifle butt nestled against the sweet spot in his shoulder, he stepped onto the tile floor. A body lying in the intersection ahead made his heart thud. But then a flash of light from the open elevator shaft illuminated skeletal remains. It wasn't Layla or Les. He moved forward until he reached the bones. The left side of the passage was blocked, but the right was clear. He didn't stop to check the remains, and continued with his finger on the trigger guard. A howling sounded outside the garage behind him, but it was just the wind. The electronic wail from earlier was gone, replaced by what sounded like clicking joints. Almost mechanical in nature, like some sort of freak robotic spider. Another body lay ahead. This time he bent down to check the helmet. The cracked visor opened to a nose and empty eye sockets. The dried skin was stretched in a mask of horror. Michael stood, wincing in pain, and checked his HUD again. The beacons were blinking from left to right. Layla and Les were moving. He still couldn't tell where they were in the facility, but he decided to try the door that stood ajar on his right, opening into a stairwell. Angling his gun downward, he moved as fast as he could. The pain in his knees had melted away in the adrenaline coursing through his body.
Layla, I'm on my way.
He pressed down the stairs, passing landing after landing with no door to the facility. On the sixth floor, he froze. Static crackled in his helmet. Commander, something's